Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, you're listening to the Retro Isle Podcast, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news, views, and interviews. I'm Ravi Abbott.
I'm Dan Wood.
Yes, and we're on episode 10.
Double figures, oh, woohoo!
Can't believe it.
Who'd have thought that when we started the show back in January?
Yeah.
10 episodes in.
We're finally there. So now we've got to hit 20, Dan.
Well, actually, it's quite a good week to mention this, that we are now, according to the officials at iTunes, new and noteworthy.
Oh, yes. We got an email today telling us. So.
Now, that this was, I will just say, it was spam that we got, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was spam. But thank you guys for listening to us on iTunes. Also, we've got, I think, 61 likes extra this week, which is quite good from last week.
On Facebook?
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, thank you so much if you liked us on Facebook, actually. If you want to find out what we're up to each week, good way to find out, isn't it, when new stuff's going on and all the shows and events we're going to be at over the summer. So there will be a link to our Facebook page. We've got the little widget down the side now.
Yeah, we've got a lovely new website as well, and Paul Kitchings help with the graphics.
Yeah, thank you so much, Paul. Now, if you have a look at theretrohour.com, because I know there will be people who have maybe found us through iTunes, just browsing through and don't know when the show comes out. We're released every Friday. Download it from iTunes, our website, theretrohour.com. The same place that you'll find all the show notes as well, because I get a load of people messaging me going, I listen on a podcast client, but I can't read the show notes. So yeah, if you want to find them,
they're all available there.
They are. And now we've got a few other podcasts we want to give a little mention to this week.
Yeah, you've been cheating on us, haven't you, Ben?
I have. I was on a podcast called the Way Back When podcast.
Ah.
Now, this is a new one. He's only on episode number 4 now, I think. A chap called Wayne who got in touch with me. He's a British guy. And it's really, he has a different person on each week for about 45 minutes to an hour and talks about their history in gaming and technology and what their interests are, you know, how they grew up with computers and all that kind of thing. So I did like pretty much a history of me.
Yeah, so if you want to hear a history of Dan Wood, then it'll be in the links.
Well, he's actually got some big names on as well. Shannon Morse, you know, Snubsy from Hack 5 and Techzilla and that. So I think she's great on his next episode. So guy's called Wayne, he's lovely. We'll leave a link in the show notes if you want to check out his podcast.
We've got another podcast as well, just to mention, which is RGDS Podcast. And they've just done a great one on the music of Golden Axe 2 and given us a shout. So we'll return the favour.
Now, every week on our show, we bring you a notable or noteworthy guest. And we've got a good one this week.
Yes, we've got Andrew Barnabas, the guy who did Swerve. Also did some great PlayStation titles. You know, he's just a demo scene master of sound, and he's kind of telling us about all his getting of samples and kind of all the old school guys, how he managed to blag his way into the industry.
It's really good stories, actually. And, you know, he's a guy that started on the Commodore 64 with the SID chip and then went to the Amiga Tracker kind of era.
Yeah, PlayStation, PC.
Yeah. So there'll be a lot of demo scene chat as well.
Yeah,
you know,
now virtual reality, actually.
He is, isn't he? Yeah, doing virtual reality for Sony. So we'll find out more about that. Andrew's on the show in around 35 to 40 minutes from now. Now, getting on to this week's big news stories then, Ravi.
Yes, so we have the Nintendo PlayStation. The boot ROM has been discovered and distributed.
Now, obviously, this was a massive story. Was it last summer?
Yeah, yeah.
It first came about. Now, for those who missed it, if you were living under a rock about a year ago now, obviously, you may not know this, but the Sony PlayStation was actually a project that kind of came out of Nintendo, wasn't it?
Yeah, as, it was kind of against Panasonic, wasn't it? Or Philips?
I think, yeah, it was basically meant to be the answer to the Mega CD on the Mega Drive and the Philips CDI. So what, you know, everyone at the time was building their own CD consoles. So Nintendo went to Sony, who did the sound chip for the Super Nintendo, didn't they, Sony?
Yeah.
So they said, oh, we want a CD add-on. So they were working together on this project that was going to be called the Super Nintendo PlayStation. So that was going to either be an add-on to the Super Nintendo or an all-in-one device. Now, about a year ago, this guy who turns out had no interest in gaming at all, he was going through his attic, and I think his dad used to work for Nintendo or Sony, and he found one of these Super Nintendo PlayStation prototypes in a box in his attic.
Yeah, people didn't believe it when he posted a picture online. People were like, what the hell is this?
Everyone called BS, didn't they? They were like, oh, you've made... Because it was actually yellowed a bit, wasn't it, like consoles do?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, it's so easy to do, just use a bit of paint or something, you know what I mean? But it was like... It turned out he didn't want to power it on, which I think kind of added to the mythology of this. because a lot of people were saying it hasn't been turned on for like, you know, 25, 30 years. If you just plug it in with the wrong power supply, because this guy knew nothing about electronics,
yeah,
it might just go bang, and then you've lost the only kind of source of this super rare. This is probably the rarest gaming prototypes ever been found, I'd say.
Yeah,
isn't
well, absolutely legendary status.
Well, yeah, you think, you know, this charted the move away from Sega and Nintendo, was like the leaders to Sony and where they came from and the PlayStation project. So anyway, they took it to a gaming show in Japan at the back end of last year, got it verified, and they actually got it powered on, and it, you know, booted up and everything as well. Now, there's a website called Retro Collect, which is a really good website. We do actually use them for a bit of news on the show.
Yeah.
But they've done an article here saying that the boot ROM has been leaked to them.
And they're saying that, you know, you can put it on an Ever drive.
Actually load it on an actual Super Nintendo. Now, they're looking at it here. They've got a little screenshot of this Super Disc BIOS kind of boot screen booting on an emulator. But they've done kind of a strip down looking at the hex code and all that as well. And they've actually done a bit of research into stuff like the patent numbers that are in here. And they've actually matched that up on, you know, Google Patents. You can search all the old patents from back in the day. They've linked this up to a patent that was filed by Sony in 1991 by the Sony Corporation. So if it is a fake, someone's done a lot of research in this. And apparently it boots up and gives you the, you know, this, we can see it here on the screenshot, the SuperDisc boot screen. And it says no CD system available, it says.
Yeah, I think it actually says that on the PlayStation prototype as well. So even on the prototype, you know, you're not booting it into the emulator, it still doesn't read the CD.
did the CD drive not work on this prototype, the fan then?
I don't know. I think it might have been powered.
Okay.
But it wasn't connected with the firmware or whatever.
I think looking at this, all they said is it's pretty much just a Super Nintendo with a CD-ROM drive in there. I don't think there's any extra kind of, you know, PlayStation hardware and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So you're not going to be able to run PS1 games. But if they do manage to get kind of, you know, if you can put this on an EverDrive, maybe you could hack like a cheap CD-ROM drive into the side of your Super Nintendo.
Yeah, just create one. Or, you know, they may be able to hack the firmware or do some really dodgy stuff.
But then you could have, you know, Super Nintendo games that are like 600-700 megabytes. So.
Ooh. Yeah,
that might be kind of cool. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
so there could be actually, you know, more to this than just a curiosity, I think, you know, now that this is in the wild, maybe people will start to finally use something from 1991.
get the nerds on it.
Now, speaking of new developments in the world of CD, it seems we talk about a new CD32 compilation every week at the moment.
Yeah, the scene's thriving and people seem to be just releasing compilations all the time. And this one is the Dizzy Collection, the Ultimate Amiga Dizzy Collection, actually.
Now, are you a fan of Dizzy?
I am. I've actually been a CD32 collector myself. I've got a copy of The Big Six, which is kind of six Dizzy games.
Mm-hmm.
Every other one's a 500 Amiga 500 version chucked on. But Fantastic Dizzy is the AGA version with a full CD soundtrack.
Oh, wow. What, is this on that Big Six compilation then?
Yeah,
is it? Okay.
So, you know, it's Codemasters release, and they say that it is one of the best CD32 titles just because of the CD soundtrack.
Well, this guy, it's Amiga J that we're talking about here. And, you know, pretty much all these compilations that we've talked about in the last couple of weeks, Amiga J is a guy that's behind most of them, isn't he?
Yeah.
But this one, of course, his attention to detail is really good as well, because he doesn't just whack them on a CD with like a crappy little boot screen. He puts like all the artwork in there, gives you a nice menu that you can select from. But even more importantly, I think, he remaps all the controls to the CD32 controller.
Yeah, and like looking here, you know, they're not very big games. Like Fast Food Dizzy, Quick Snacks and Fantastic. I used to have that on one disc. And I think Quick Snacks was never officially released as well. So some of these are a bit iffy, these Dizzy games. But, you know.
Well, I mean, Dizzy was. It was an 8-bit game originally, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So I know there were ports to 16-bit platforms. But yeah, I think I had a compilation floppy. It had stuff like Stunt Car Racer on there, an X-Copy, and it had loads of utilities. And then, like, I think it took about, like, 100K. There was, like, Treasure Island Dizzy was on there as well.
Yeah, that's it. Tiny games, aren't they?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. So sticking, like, 11 of them on a CD, you're not running out of space, are you? So he may as well use that extra space he's got available for music and graphics and all that kind of thing. So if you want to download this, we'll pop a link in the show notes, as always. This is quite an interesting little website that you came across during the week. It's called Save the Sounds.
Yes, it's a really good little website. It's a guy's basically compiling sounds from the past that we've forgotten about or may need saving. And he calls it the Museum of Endangered Sound. And you can basically click on these little GIFs and it will play your sounds from the past. Should we go ahead, Dan, and see?
You want me to test you here, then?
Yeah, you need to test me.
So, yeah, you look.
Bear in mind, I have been on this site playing on it for quite a while. So.
Okay, I'm going to pick some obscure ones then. Okay.
Yeah.
What's this?
Oh God, is that a warning?
No.
Play it again.
These machines still use a similar sound today.
Mac? Is it something to do with
Mac? It's an old PowerPC Mac startup, yeah.
Ah, okay.
What should we have? Listen to this one. No, this is not a modem.
Dial tone or no? Oh, yeah, a dial-up 56K, isn't it?
No,
it's not a modem.
This is a Sinclair Spectrum loading.
Oh, God, I'm sorry, I'm not a Spectrum guy. People are probably going, Sinclair Spectrum, shouting at the radio now.
Do you have another one? What's this one?
ICQ.
AOL Messenger, nearly.
Oh, what was ICQ?
That's ICQ.
Oh, my God.
One more.
Ah, yes, the heavenly sound of Windows 95. Hospital, I remember.
There was actually one Windows startup sound. Because Windows 95 was quite chirpy and friendly, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I remember we used to use this at school.
It's very futuristic, that.
Crap myself when I heard that. That's Windows NT starting up. But yeah, this website though, it's savethesounds.info if you want to have a look at it. Got Tamagotchi on there as well.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, I think audio is such a big part of the experience, isn't it? Everyone talks about, graphics and... Oh, there we go, it's going again. Everyone talks about the graphics and, the packaging and the actual systems, but I think audio is generally kind of a forgotten part of the experience, isn't it?
It really is. You know, when you play people old games and stuff, they go, oh, I didn't know it sounded this fabulous.
Yeah, and
that's always the first thing that they say, you know.
I think it's kind of up there with, like, smells, isn't it, as well? It's kind of like, something that can just transport you back. So I think it's important to preserve this stuff as well because there can't be many other websites where you've got, a dot matrix printer. Sound effects,
and I guess, the lifespan of some of these stuff was quite small.
Yeah,
so,
well,
the messaging services and stuff. So
I was watching, there's a show that's been on the BBC recently. It's called Back in Time for the Weekend. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've been watching that. It's great.
Yeah, it's a family, if you haven't seen it. It's a family who, every episode, they move into a different decade, don't they? And they live their life.
They start from, the 50s, 50s and go up to modern, well, even into the future. They're doing future tech as the next one.
Well, the last one was 90s, wasn't it? Yeah.
Really?
But I think the biggest thing, and even the girl in the show, she's only about 15, they got a PC and then they got one of those iMacs, didn't she? And she's saying, we only got that 3 years ago. But I think it was this era. Technology seemed to move a lot quicker than it does now, New consoles came out the Xbox One and the PS4. It was nearly a decade after the last generation, wasn't it? But you think of the 90s, you went from the Amiga CD32 to the Jaguar to the PlayStation, all within 3 years. It was.
And for two or three of those years, I was using ICQ.
Yeah.
And every day. And I was getting, uh-oh, all the time.
All sound like a lemming to me.
Yeah.
So, I think, it's important to preserve these because these are really nostalgic, the stuff you think, oh, God, I remember that. You know what I mean? So it's a great website, savethesounds.info, and I'm sure that you'll be adding to it as time goes on.
I totally forgot about my ICQ days.
Do you remember your login number?
Oh, God, no.
I think mine was something 951660. It definitely
people will start trying to log in, Dan.
I've been trying myself now, yeah. Now, 3D printing retro console cases.
Yes, this is really good. So these are kind of console cases that people have been printing, but at the moment, 3D printers are kind of small, the amount of stuff you can do. So they're making little Raspberry Pi cases, kind of Game Boy style cases, small little arcade units. And they're amazing. These designs are kind of ones that can be shared throughout the 3D printing community. So,
you can download your own and...
Yeah, someone makes their own Raspberry Pi NES case and then you can download it on your 3D printer.
That's crazy, isn't it? It still blows my mind, 3D printing.
Well, they're actually talking about how they started 3D printing human parts.
Yeah, so, knees and stuff and joints and that kind of thing.
And things like that.
Won't be long till you can print yourself a girlfriend out.
That's it, yeah.
But you're looking here as well, and it says you can download these 3D print files for free, as you said, print them out and enjoy them yourself. There are even websites you can use where you can send the files and they'll send it back in the post to you.
But these aren't crappy consoles as well. There's this NES looks giant.
Have you seen the PlayStation? Look at the PlayStation one. How cute is that?
It's amazing.
But these are, I mean, we talked about the Raspberry Pi 3 last week, and these fit the Raspberry Pi 3. Mm. And because the Pi's actually got a DSP port that you can plug a display into, some of these cases here, it's got the room for a screen in there too, so you can basically make your own Game Boy with the emulation on there.
Yeah, totally. Maybe in the future you'll get your consoles delivered via a printer.
That's great. I'm sure you will. Like, you know, with the PlayStation 6, you just download it and print it out. Yeah. So I'll pop a link in the show notes if you want to check these out. Very, very interesting, though. And if you've got a Raspberry Pi, there's even one here. You can print out your own arcade cabinet for them. So I'm doing well with my Raspberry Pis, actually. I've set two of them up now. So
What, are you using your 3 yet, or is it not arrived?
Yeah, my three, all set up now. I actually did a video for it on YouTube. We've now got, you know, shiny new website, as we mentioned before. Ravi and I's YouTube channels are on there. So if you want to see my Raspberry Pi 3 setup video, I've noticed, though, have you seen, apparently this one gets really hot.
Yeah, 100 degrees.
100 degrees Celsius, apparently, yeah. And I've been using the old chargers that I use in my 2, and I'm getting that little rainbow in the corner quite a lot, even with the 2.1.
Okay.
So I think I need a beefier power supply for it.
Well, I've had to recently go back to the Raspberry Pi 1.
Okay.
After using the 2 and everything. It is so slow.
Yeah.
It's just like, come on.
We've got them in here. There's one up there, I think, in this room we're in now, but you can even, just trying to do anything on it, you forget. I was trying to get a website the other day. I was like, come on.
I'd installed Linux, and it was like, open browser.
Yeah. Unusable,
isn't it,
really?
What people were doing with it, and that was just a few years
ago. 2 years ago, yeah. Talking about things coming on quick, they still are, what I mean? Now, this is a pretty sad story. I mean, I think 2016, we talked about Dave Needle passing away. Someone else who I think modern society owes a lot to has passed away.
Definitely. The kind of communications revolution.
Probably the biggest revolution in human history for communication.
Definitely.
Ray Tomlinson, who was the inventor of email.
Yes, and the selector of the at symbol.
Yeah, so he's the guy that actually decided that the at symbol was going to be used to address people on email. Yeah. And the crazy thing about this is, you look through, not only you think, all right, email, when did you start using email? When did you get your first address?
Hotmail, probably. Yeah.
Same here.
Yeah.
I actually got a bit depressed the other day because I got an email off Hotmail saying something like, you've been using it for 18 years or something. I was like, oh, shit, I'm old. But it turns out he invented email in 1971. And it wasn't he was at university at the time, but this wasn't an assignment he got or anything. In fact, he was playing around with the mainframes at MIT, it says here.
It was for the ARPANET, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, ARPANET, that was a pre-runner to the internet, wasn't
it? Yeah, so if you guys don't know, there was lots of kind of networks for the internet, but email was a protocol that was before the World Wide Web.
Oh, long 20 years before.
20 years before, but, instant delivery of mail. It's amazing.
But I love the fact that when he made email, he revealed in an interview with Forbes in the mid-90s, he said, he was worried that he might get in trouble for using the university's computer time for something he wasn't meant to. He was just fooling around, and he came up with arguably, the most important communication tool in human history, just accidentally, really.
If the email service went at my work, I think the place would be in pandemonium,
But you think of everything else that has changed since, like, the earliest days of computers. Email's always been there.
Yeah. And honestly, we've not moved on that far.
No.
Like, if you look at Twitter, it's 32 characters. Mm-hmm. It's in real time, fair dues. It's not being delivered. We still can't deliver that kind of information in as good a way as email.
And it still uses the at symbol.
Yeah.
Twitter.
Yeah, true.
So rest in peace, Ray Tomlinson. He's only 74 as well, far too young.
Definitely.
Now, a Super Mario theme park is coming to Japan.
Yes. So they're going to build a $250 million Super Mario theme park in Japan. This reminds me of Sega World. Do you remember
Sega
that?
Sega World, yeah? I do. What, in London?
Yeah, Trocadero. That was a really amazing place. I used to force my dad to take me there.
I remember seeing that on, like, I think first time I saw it was on Games Master or something when it first opened.
Yeah, it was in the late 90s, wasn't it?
I think it was about mid-90s. I think it was about 94, 95 it might have been.
Okay, because I remember later on they used to do lots of London hacking meets there.
Mm.
Even though Sega World had shut down,
yeah,
the hackers would still meet at the bottom of Sega World.
Well, we were talking off air before and you mentioned about the escalators.
Oh, yeah. It was like designed like a giant pinball machine. So you kind of go on the escalators and they'd have these rings around them. And it was like
Sonic Spinball, wasn't it?
Yeah. And you'd have a big wall of CRTs at the side. And it was kind of, you'd go up this central circular shaft and then there'd be all these different floors with go-karting.
Yeah.
People spinning around in gyroscopes, silent scope. My dad going mad on, what is it, Dance Dance Revolution?
But because I lived in London like for a few years before I came to Nottingham. I moved here about, 2010, I think I moved here.
Yeah.
But I'd often go in the Trocadero, and it would still have all of the kind of Sega World layout, and the escalators were still like the rings and all that, but it'd be like just, you know, crappy little market stores and stuff by then, with a little arcade at the side. But I was quite sad to read, I haven't actually been in there for about 2 years, but apparently they're turning it all into a hotel now.
Oh, no.
But there were some pictures on a website of the top floor in Sega World that had kind of been abandoned since they closed Sega World down, and apparently there's still some of the old signage up there and that kind of thing.
Oh, wow.
On the top, or like, you know, this secret floor at the top still. So a couple of guys had snuck up with some cameras. There might be a video on YouTube to it, if I can find it. I'll...
Yeah, I think there's actually some old videos of Sega World anyway on YouTube.
Yeah, there is a couple on there. But there's also, because this Nintendo thing is going to be a theme park, there was actually a Sega theme park in Australia, I think it was, in Sydney.
Okay.
It was only open for about 4 years, but because... I'm quite into looking at abandoned porn, as you might be able to tell from, you know, that Sega World story then. But there's actually, it was abandoned pretty much for about 7 years, I think.
Yeah.
So it shut down in 2000. They didn't demolish it until 2008, actually, looking at this. And there are a group of guys that went through and took loads of pictures of, like, you know, the Sonic kind of burger shack and all that kind of thing and the old abandoned rides. A lot of them still
dystopian
there.
Dystopian Sega World, you know.
But it is sex. I mean, that was built in 97 when Sega, all right, now the Saturn was out by then and their glory days had kind of gone a bit, but it was... But I think the fact that Nintendo are kind of taking a chance and doing something similar...
It's really good. You know, they've said it will be completed by 2020.
In time for the Tokyo Olympics.
Yes, and it's going to be all Super Mario and your kind of Pokemon and all of this stuff.
It still blows my mind that 2020 is only 4 years away.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I saw that. I thought that's ages away. Yeah, 10 years, isn't it?
and you know, Nintendo, they're a bit struggling, and we don't want to see them go the way of Atari or Commodore or any of these guys, you know.
So, or even Sega.
Or even Sega, yeah, indeed. Can you believe all the giants that have gone? You know, Nintendo's like one of the last standing kind of old-school game companies, isn't it?
And they are, you know, they're kind of at a stage now where, you know, they're really swimming for the life, aren't they? They don't want to sink, but it's... I think this is quite interesting, though. I mean, Japan has got such a different culture to over here. They tried to do this in, like, America or England. It'd go bankrupt within 2 years, I think, but... In Japan, the arcade industry is still thriving.
It's crazy.
Still arcades, yeah. You can go over there and it's like, you know, like they used to be here in the 90s.
There's even this game, Kaplinko, that they just Japanese are obsessed with. And it's like pinball with like 100 balls. You've just got to kind
of... We've had it bars and all that.
Yeah. And they just sit there playing it.
Well, I think, you know, because Sega do make arcade units still, don't they? But I think they're pretty much exclusively for Japan now.
Yeah.
Although that said, in Nottingham, there is a new little arcade that's opened here in town. I saw in the corner house in Nottingham.
Mm.
I was there on Saturday.
I also saw photos of you bowling with your missus.
It's a great little arcade, though, and they've got some of the, it's kind of the, you know, the Sonic basketball one from, probably from about 2000, 2001, because it's got the old, you know, Sonic Adventure logo on it and all that.
The crazy thing that I saw was I actually went past there the other day and I saw that they had a lot of Android games, like Crossy Road, if you've ever played
Crossy
Road.
And they've got Flappy Bird there as well.
Flappy Bird, yeah. And you've just got a big button and you've just got to bash it. And it's like taking these mobile casual games onto a giant arcade unit. It actually works quite well.
Because I've always said, you know, I miss the days of going to arcades, and I was in town with the missus on Saturday, we had a bit of food, and then I just walked past it. I was like, she said, oh yeah, it's been there about 7 months. I was like, what?
Why didn't you tell me?
So I dragged her in there and we're playing there. There's Outrun 2 cabinets in there and stuff as well.
You see the Star Wars one, they've got a full
circular. I didn't have a go on that
Star Wars.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just cool to go and hang out in an arcade again. It felt very different to what it did back in the old days. Maybe it's because I'm an adult now, but I imagine if you went to one in Japan, it'd probably feel kind of similar, maybe, you know.
Yeah, maybe there'll probably still be guys smoking in there.
But yeah, if you're going over for the Tokyo Olympics, make sure you have a look at this Super Mario theme park opening in 2020. £250 million investment.
Yeah, if they've not spent the £250 million on saving themselves.
Yeah, actually, yeah, we might need it for the Olympics, actually. Now, have you heard of AmiKit?
I have, and I used to write guides for it for the EEE PC, which was this tiny little Asus PC back in the
day. Was that the first netbook?
Yeah,
I remember that thing.
Really slow.
Well, it was, wasn't it? Yeah. Netbooks didn't last very long, did they? That was a phase that came and gone.
Yeah, it'd give you, like, cripple your fingers.
I remember trying to type, you'd have to use your little pinkies.
Yeah.
But AmiKit, if you haven't heard of it, it's, to put it simply for guys that are not into Amiga emulation, it's basically a bunch of programs that you can install on an Amiga emulator, and it gives you all the most used essential programs.
And it's all set up as well, isn't it? So, like, you want to go on the internet, you just load it up and open a browser.
The browser's already included too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not like you have to install everything and do it through this massive configuration slog.
And it even makes it look sexy. They put all modern icons on there. There's an FTP, like, server built in.
One thing I don't like about it is why have you got a start menu on there, dude? Remove that. But yeah.
I noticed that as well. Do you remember the stage in the mid-90s there when all Amiga users had, there's so many start menu clones
Amiga
being released?
Start. Yeah, like, this, yeah, yeah.
Why does everyone want to be like Windows? You know, I mean, we hated Windows a couple of years ago.
Well, actually, I was watching that Fine Brothers video. We know about the Fine Brothers controversy, but they had a really good one, which was kids using Windows 95.
Oh, okay.
And that's just come out today. And the hilarious part was that they had a monitor on top of CRT, and they all just sit there and turn the CRT on.
Thinking it's a computer.
Yeah, and it's like, no, you've got to turn the actual unit on underneath, you know?
God, man.
And that was the first use of the start menu but even in 95.
Like, even now, you know, on a modern desktop PC, you'd still have to turn the monitor and the PC on separately. It proves that they don't even use desktops, doesn't it?
Yeah,
you know, they're probably still with a modern desktop.
Yeah.
But getting back to this AmiKit X. So they're using kind of the Mac terminology there. AmiKit 10.
Yeah.
They've just released a preview of it. Now, there is Aeon, who make a lot of the Amiga OS 4 boards. They've actually come out with this thing called the Alice Laptop.
I'm going to try and remember what it was. Amiga-like... creative emulation.
I think you got every single one of them wrong, actually, Ravi. It was a laptop incorporating a classic experience.
Oh, there you go.
So this is really just a standard PC laptop that comes pre-installed with Amiga emulation on board. Yeah. But you can run, like all your old games and all that, with WHD lugs. It's emulating 68K.
Nice.
But with this new version of AmiKit, you can also run Linux apps straight on the Amiga's workbench.
Okay. That's
so,
really good.
Well, they've released this video today, video preview, and it shows VLC playing a video on the Amiga's workbench.
Wow. That's pretty useful, actually, because there's not a lot of things are compatible. You know, Office Suites, Amiga lacks a lot on.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could just open, I don't know, LibreOffice or,
And looking at it as well, I mean, it runs in kind of a window here that looks a bit like, you know, when you open UAE, for example, on Windows and you get it in a... It's in its own environment, which it is at the moment, but I'm sure it's they can do like transparent kind of skins and stuff to make it look like it's part of the OS, which I'm sure, you know, they're probably going to be working on a bit more. But this, I love what they're calling this, Linux kind of layer in there. It's called Rabbit Hole. So it's kind of like, you know, like Alice in Wonderland.
And also you can get this on a USB stick.
Yeah,
it's quite cool.
Yeah,
so you could just like go and stick it in any machine and boot off the USB, I think.
We'll pop a link if you want to find out a bit more. This is a news article on Amiga World. Now, I thought this is quite an interesting talking point. Getting them started right was the subject on Reddit. And I've seen guys on 4chan are probably in like the 30s now. They've got kids and they want to get the kids into gaming. So what they've been doing is... You know, they say, I want my son to have, like, you know, a good all-rounded experience of gaming. So he's not allowed a Wii U. He's not allowed a PlayStation 4. He's got to have an Atari 2600. That's all he's allowed. And then next year, he's allowed a Super Nintendo for, no, a NES for a year.
Luddites.
Yeah, well, it's like pretty much they want their kids to experience gaming from the beginning up till now because they think it'll give them some kind of more of an appreciation of it.
Okay, more of a kind of a rounded understanding of the development of stuff, I guess,
So that is one argument to it. What do you think of doing that?
I don't know, because originally I thought, wouldn't it be good if I just, like, closed my kids' mind off, had them in a closed Amiga environment, and then grew them all the way up to kind of modern day, and then gave them a PC and they'd realise how crap it was. Mm-hmm. But I think, no, actually... There's so much good stuff out there for kids at the moment. The Raspberry Pi, you know, everyone's starting to learn coding on it. You don't need to go back to that old stuff. You know, there's new stuff. There's kind of gyroscopes, accelerometers, there's Bluetooth. There's loads of really cool stuff that they can do. So I think it's kind of making your kid irrelevant.
Yeah.
It's like dressing your kid in flares when it's not the 70s, you know.
Well, there's this article on The Onion of this, you know, it's a fake article, but this dad who didn't want his daughter to listen to Justin Bieber and that, you know, she got to listen to proper music. So there's a picture of her with like a Talking Heads on vinyl.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's like, oh, gee, thanks, Dad. You know what I mean? Like, but
like
it's...
in the playground, have you heard the new Madonna song, Just Like a Prayer? And it's
you know
like,
what, I mean?
What are you on about?
I think if your kids take an interest in it, but... you know, then great. I've got guys who are retro gaming guys on Facebook and I see them at the weekends, you know, sitting down with the kids and playing like James Pond and that. And I think if the kids are like, oh, you know, I want to try Dad's games and that, wonderful. But
I think it's a bit different as well now because when we were kids, it was like everyone was chasing that new technology and chasing the latest.
There was
thing.
No retro really then, was it?
No, no.
It hadn't been around long enough.
But now people are like, you know, Minecraft, that's been around for... What is it, 10 years now or 5 years?
It must be, yeah, like 6, 7 maybe, yeah.
But, you know, kids just get into Minecraft and then they just stay there. Mm-hmm. It's not like the
Yeah, we got a new console every 3 years, didn't we?
Yeah. I want that. Yeah, we were just constantly buying up the latest game, the fastest one, you know.
I think there are, and I think some guys in the retro gaming community are probably guilty of this, and I don't think we are, but guys who kind of just live in the past.
Yeah, yeah, I think they do. They're not willing to accept that, you know, stuff's going to move on. And that's quite bad, actually, because then they're always doing comparisons, and it's like they're totally different things, you know. Virtual reality and stuff is going to be amazing. And I'm really looking forward to that. And
we're both guys that love modern tech as well as old stuff.
Yeah,
we just happen to do a retro podcast.
Yeah, if I had kids, I wouldn't want to deny them virtual reality and have them on the Virtual Boy. Yeah.
A friend asked me on Facebook recently, put a thread like, you know, if you could go back to like 1982 and live there again, would you, or something? The fact that I was born that year, you know what I mean? Yeah. But it's like, the fact is, I really would not go back in time, like even to like 20 years ago, over now. I'd rather be here now.
Yeah, I'd go back in time and punch all of the board of Commodore in the face and then come back.
I'd go back for a day, don't get me wrong, it'd be awesome, but I wouldn't want to live there again, not having access to always on broadband internet. And I think you get bored out your brain in like 5 minutes, everybody do. But I think now you've got access to all the best of the stuff we had then. You think of the Amiga you had when you were a kid. Now you've got an Amiga with a 160 gigabyte hard disk in there with every single game on there.
Just playing Duke Nukem 3D on a Vampire 600, you know. It's
you know, you wouldn't believe that if you said that when you were a kid. You can just literally download any game you want for your computer in a second.
Yeah.
I think now we're living in the best time for technology and gaming ever.
Oh, definitely. And I think because it's so unknown as well, it's like with gaming, you knew for a while what it was going to be. It was going to be CD and then video would come in. We knew that video was going to become big. Now we knew virtual reality is going to come big. Mm-hmm. But what's after that? There wasn't a race for any tech, so I think it's all new, isn't it?
I mean, getting back to the topic we're talking about here about kids, I think they are growing up in, like, you know, probably an even more exciting time than we did in many ways.
Yeah.
They haven't got kind of the, you know, I think a lot of it was very unknown when we were kids. And
well, we had the whole communications revolution, didn't we? We had
the web.
They've got the interaction revolution with the tablets and the kind of, you know, ways of talking to each other, where before it was just we don't have to use a payphone, we've got a mobile now.
You know what, though? What blew my mind? I was reading an article in, I think it was a Guardian it was in. It was this guy, and he's about 26, and I think he's got a younger, like, stepsister, and she's 14. Mm. And she's like really, she's got like, I'm not exactly sure how Snapchat works, I'm not a big user of Snapchat, but she sends something like 350 Snapchats every single day. Mm. And she's, you get rep on there, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And he has basically said, you know, he wanted to, he's like one of the technology guys for The Guardian, he wanted to understand it a bit more. So he said, well, I've got my 14-year-old sister. And she was showing him how to use Snapchat. And apparently she can reply to like 100 Snapchats in like 10 minutes. She just goes, taking selfies. Doesn't even read them, apparently. Swipe, 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 click, 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 click. And he's a guy who's like, he's 26. You'd still consider him a young man, but he's like, I couldn't get my head around this. I'm like, teenagers are communicating in such a different way.
They are, totally.
And using technology, you know, we can't get our heads around it. It's like, we're in our 30s
and
now.
And it's also that constant kind of access as well. You know, it's like, if they're not talking to you on WhatsApp or Facebook, it's on another Snapchat. Or you know, there's no getting away from it now.
Yeah.
You know, before we could, like, chat to people and then go and watch TV with your parents, Top of the Pops, and then, you know, but now it's just bam, 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 bam.
If you didn't log into IRC, you know, you wouldn't hear from them like a week, you know what I mean?
But it's like, or if the person wasn't online, you know.
All the kids are doing that now, and I think, you know, if you only give them a Commodore 64, they're going to miss out on quite a lot, aren't they?
They'll just try and get a Twitter client or something.
Well, you can't do that, can't you? Yeah. So, next story then, MAME.
Ah, MAME.
And MAME is wonderful. Especially, you know, we said then about things that blew our mind today that we didn't have when we were kids, having every single arcade in your house.
Yeah, that you can run on pretty much anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, now MAME is open source.
Oh, excellent. That's great, because it's a really good engine for just playing kind of arcade images.
You know? Well, I've just read something. Can you believe that MAME's been going for 19 years?
Oh, wow.
So after 19 years, they've basically tracked down everyone that's ever contributed to this project. Apparently, that took them the last 10 months to get in touch with everyone. Everyone's basically said, you know, that's fine. Release it under the general public license, GPL. The fact that they've now made it open source, I'd imagine that's going to mean that, you know, people can bundle it with projects and you can do
Yeah, so you could probably get it preloaded on hardware now, and it'll make it a lot more easier for people that don't have this kind of niche configuration geeky knowledge.
Yeah, it's quite hard to set up sometimes, isn't
yeah,
it?
You know, especially with ROMs and stuff like this.
Yeah, we mentioned before the ROMs, you can get them from archive.org, you know, as a massive torrent if you want them. But people are probably going to make their own kind of builds of this now, maybe unofficial kind of, well, you know, it doesn't have to be unofficial anymore, or official.
Yeah.
Different versions of it. And so it's quite cool to see where it'll go, you know, port to other platforms and that kind of
there
stuff.
There might be like kind of mods coming out for it or weird things that will do different stuff.
Even just looking at it and seeing like, you know, how it works is quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Now, this is a headline that really leapt out at me when I read it. Nintendo is bringing back the SNES.
Clickbait.
Now, there is... I've got a Wii U and I've got a 3DS as well. And for a couple of years now, they've kind of had this... I can't remember, some virtual Nintendo store or something. What it is, it's basically running old Nintendo system games on their modern platforms.
That you can download?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So it's all DLC. You know, you get it off the Nintendo store. But they are going to be bringing out a special edition of the 3DS XL that looks like an old Super Nintendo.
Oh, wow. This looks really nice. This reminds me of the PlayStation 4 they did.
The 20th anniversary edition or whatever
it was. Yeah, the original one.
Yeah, that I remember the PS4, that was grey, wasn't it? And the buttons were all like the triangle and that, like on the original. But this, you're looking at it here, so it is, you know, it's a 3DS XL. But it's got the styling of the top of the Super Nintendo or the Famicom, because it's a Japanese model.
Super respect for having this. Like, it would look so cool playing on it.
Well, it is. It's that old grey colour scheme, and even the buttons are, like, you know, the same. Blue, red, yellow and green, like they were on the SNES.
Yeah.
They are saying that this is only going to be released in Japan, apparently, though.
So it'll become rare and expensive. And it'll be really
Nintendo
good.
Stuff's expensive as it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's... well, there's no plans yet, apparently, but it's going to sell for $190, apparently, in Japan. So worth a trip out there to get a few of these, isn't it? And visit the arcade while you're out there as well, in the theme park. Check out the Olympics. Do it all.
Yeah.
Right, the final topic. This is quite interesting. Haunted video games.
Should have saved this for Halloween, Dan.
I'd have forgotten by then, you know, my brain works. Now, this is a new game. It's a roguelike game, so it's turn by turn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Spellraiser. Now, there's an alpha available now that you can download for free if you want to try it out. And it's kind of, they say it's a haunted video game from 1981. That's the premise. And looking at it, it's very kind of Tron looking, isn't it? It's all that neon and...
Yeah. It's kind of an above view thing as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a rogue game, pretty much. So the story is that it is an old video game from 1981 that got abandoned, never got released, apparently due to problems in development and testing. And then someone's found this code in, like, a warehouse 30 years later, converted it to modern systems, and then it starts taking on a sinister life of its own, apparently.
Well, I'm watching the trailer at the moment, and every 5 seconds, this crazy kind of kaleidoscope's keeps
looks
going
like it's glitching,
in.
doesn't it? Yeah. So there's even stuff like DOS code and all that in there as well that you kind of go into. So I think it looks really cool, you know, for someone who I do get a nostalgic kick off that kind of visual style anyway.
Yeah. And these kind of video game legends, which are really interesting, you know, these kind of little stories about the past and what might have happened.
Well, this got us looking at an article that I read a few years ago. It's on a website called listverse.com. And this is the top 10 creepy video game urban legends.
Okay.
Now, I'll mention two of them on here, two of the most famous ones. One of them is called Killswitch.
Yep.
Now, apparently this was a game that really existed in 1989, and it was made in the Soviet Union just before the fall of it.
And they had Tetris coming from the Soviet Union and others, so it's... Yeah.
Soviet games, didn't the government actually own them, didn't they? I remember seeing the guy from Texas didn't get any money or something,
which is interesting because they were selling well in America during the Cold War.
Bizarre. But apparently, this was one of the first survival horror games. So in this game, you had two characters to pick from. You could either be a little girl or a demon.
Okay.
And you had to go through an abandoned coal mine and battle the monsters and demons and all that. And most people would pick the demon because it's cooler than playing with a little girl. But apparently, nobody ever managed to complete the game with the demon because when you did, just as you got to the end, this game would completely erase all traces of itself from your hard disk permanently.
That's amazing. So, like, you wouldn't be able to copy it.
Yeah. No one knew the way. You know, you play the game, it get deleted. if this was true, there probably would be some code out there somewhere, you'd think. Yeah. But, you know, it is an urban legend.
Urban myths.
However, it got more interesting when we got to 2005. Now, an unopened copy of this game, apparently on a physical format, which you think you'd just reinstall it, wouldn't you, if it was on a floppy or whatever, but there you go.
Copy that floppy.
But apparently it surfaced on eBay, and it was bought for $733,000 by a man from Japan. Now, he meant to do a series of YouTube videos documenting the gameplay and showing and all that, but apparently he only posted one video, and that was him sitting at his computer screen crying. And no one's ever heard anything about it since.
That is so surreal.
So, that is, you know, one interesting video game legend. Have you ever seen the Haunted Majora's Mask video?
No, I've not seen that.
Now, this was, apparently this guy, he was on a market stall and he found a blank N64 cartridge with Majora's Mask written on it and a black marker pen.
Yeah.
And when he put the game in, he noticed there was a save game on the cartridge called Ben. So he ignored it and tried to start a new game, but found out that apparently all of the other characters in the game would still call him Ben in the game.
Okay.
So he deleted the file off the cartridge and thought, oh, you know, this is pissing me off. And then he found the game had become really erratic, like the music had started playing backwards apparently in the game, and his character got followed around by a statue. Basically, Link following himself around the game with a creepy smile on his face. And then the next day, boots up, the Ben file is back on the cart again, along with a new file that just said drowned underneath. So you had Ben drowned. That's what it was.
Wow.
And then every time he played the game, those two files would appear and creepy messages would appear across the screen. His character would just instantly die in the game.
You're scaring me, Dan.
So, but I think the most famous one, we'll finish on this, is an arcade called Polybius.
Polybius, okay.
Now, apparently this appeared, this mysterious black arcade cabinet, in the early 1980s, around the time of, like, you know, Tempest and Pac-Man, Asteroids, all that kind of thing, in an arcade in Oregon, and it was the only one of its kind, and all the kids that played it suffered health problems after, including amnesia, blackouts, nausea, seizures, headaches, night terrors, and in some cases, apparently a few kids committed suicide after playing this game.
Wow.
Now, apparently the guys that worked in the arcade said they didn't know where it came from, and every now and then some men in black could come and kind of fiddle around with the circuit boards in the back. So
maybe it's a really crap company or something, you don't know.
Bad refresh rate, but there was. Yeah. It was referenced on The Simpsons when Bart was in an arcade once, and you can see there is a Polybius arcade next to him, and it says property of the US government on the bottom of it. So.
Wow. Well, on this kind of theme, there's a really good book called Ready Player One, which is about to become a movie, and that's all about these kind of... It's about virtual reality future and stuff, but it all goes back to these arcade games, Tempest, all of these kind of little tricks in the game and stuff, and it's a really good kind of imagination of it. So check that book out, Ready Player One.
If you're nostalgic for the old arcade days. Yeah. Right, guys, thank you so much for checking out episode 10 of The Retro Hour.
I can't believe it.
And of course, you can get the show every single Friday from the website, theretrohour.com. iTunes, if you listen on there, please do leave a review. We always appreciate the feedback.
Yeah, and YouTube as well. Subscribe and drop us a comment.
And check out the shiny new website at theretrohour.com. Now, we'll leave you with this week's guest. A little chat about the old school demo days.
Andrew Barnabas is the man. All right, so... How did you first start getting into computers then?
I was just a bit of a geek right from a very early age. My mum remembers that even age 3 or 4, when the guy would come round to fix the washing machine, little 3-year-old me would be very interested to see what it looked like inside. Realised I was a bit of a nerd, and then so age 7, enrolled me as the youngest member of Croydon Computer Club. In 1980. I'm just giving away my age here. So, yes.
And what systems would you be using in Croydon Computer Club?
Kind of research machines. 480Zs, 380Zs. Pre-BASIC. There was possibly a Commodore PET there. There would have been possibly a ZX80. I think a Sinclair ZX80 was also probably there. But, yeah, I can't remember. I was 7. It was a long time ago. I can't remember exactly what was there. But, yeah, some really old computers in Croydon Library full of some slightly dusty old geezers and massive, huge computers, which didn't do a great deal.
You're one of those kids that used to take everything apart in the house then, were you?
I wasn't quite that bad. But, yeah, I think if my mum had given me more screwdrivers, it would have been a much different, a very different picture. But, yeah, so basically I started... mucking around with computers probably about 1980. We didn't own a home computer at home until 1986, when my mum got us a second-hand Commodore 64. So when we got our 64, we spent, I think, every single day on the Easter holidays. We get up in the morning, spend all day on the computer, go to sleep, get up and do it again. And played an enormous amount of games and learned to program. I was interested in, obviously, BASIC was the first thing many people learned. And got further into it, started dabbling with assembly language, machine code, and got further and further into that. Got quite involved in the demo scene. First by responding to adverts on Zap 64 magazine. Mm-hmm. Originally just a sort of, I think they just called it pen pals at the back of the mag. And you literally sort of send off a letter to somebody and go, yes, I'd like to sort of swap stuff with you. And then I remember what, from the word go, somebody sent us a 5¼-inch floppy full of, I think it was a music disc, actually. Mm-hmm. I think it was like a music disc by some at that time demo scene composers. We'd never seen anything like it. Or at that point, we'd just literally seen business stuff and games. And my brother and I was enormously intrigued by this. And so we started looking more into it and responding to more adverts and the back of this Zap 64 and getting more and more stuff from different demo scene crews from all over the UK, and started sort of writing the odd little demo to sort of show to people and everything else. You asked me how I got into computers, mm-hmm. but what's sort of an interesting parallel is that almost exactly the same time I was getting into music. So this is why the two interests sort of became pretty obvious to kind of join together.
Well, I was going to say, with the Commodore 64, though, I mean, you were essentially banging the metal a lot of the time, weren't you, with the SID chip? It was, if you're doing it in BASIC, even that, it was pokes and peaks and that kind of thing, wasn't it?
It was. Future Composer was a little bit more involved in that, fortunately, because they had like a built-in drum set, for example, built-in bass sounds and everything else. So he was simply choosing kind of one of the presets which they'd already invented. But the great thing about it is I loved Rob Hubbard's music. He was always my, as someone regarded me as the Elvis of the 64.
Yeah.
Martin Galway, David Whittaker, Ben DeGleish, all the big famous UK composers. But then when Maynex Noise kind of made this marvellous entrance, I forget what year they sort of came in, 87, 88, doing a lot of music for some of the Mastertronic games, which, again, being rather poor from that part in those days, could only really afford the 199, 299 games rather than the enormously expensive 999 games. Mm-hmm. And the music they had on those games were also equally brilliant. But you could tell, being kind of reasonably well-known and successful on that, all the composers of those days had to write their own music engines. They couldn't just pick one off the shelf. Mm-hmm. So you could tell a Rob Hubbard track, many cases, simply because of the sounds we use, in the same way that I could quite identify a David Whittaker one, less of Ben DeGleish, and a bit more Martin Galway. But Maynex Noise had a very distinctive sound. And so when I managed to get hold of Future Composer, then that was clearly, for me, that was what I was going to want to write for.
I guess you could start using your knowledge of music notation and kind of stuff, and then using it with the computer then, once this software came through.
Well, that's again, I think one of the reasons why it made so much more sense to me is because a lot of people I know who are also sort of dabbling in music in the 64 demo scene, most of them were predominantly programmers. They had very little sort of formal musical training. Whereas I gone to musical school learning various instruments, I was already pretty close to getting, when I felt I had already got my GCSE music when the Amiga arrived. But anyway, so that was all well and good. But then when the Amiga arrived, what really changed for me was when someone showed me Soundtracker, the original tracker program. The reason why that was so much more successful for me, it's because the way you could see and effectively debug the music, it was all displayed in front of you. Whereas on the Future Composer, all you would see was like a page of zeros and ones. After seeing that, I was just immediately hooked.
Well, I mean, even as a kid who came from the 8-bit scene, I was the same as well. Did you find it was like a quantum leap, wasn't it, going from like the Commodore 64 to the Amiga, just in everyday, you know, the graphics, the GUI, for example, you know, before you jump into BASIC when you turn your C64 on. Did you have to like retrain yourself quite a lot then?
I suppose like anything else, I'd already experienced it from the likes of going over to friends going over to mates' houses who had a lot more money than we did. Mm-hmm. So they always had the newer thing much earlier than we did. So I'd already seen the 64 many years before we had one, in the same way I'd already seen the Amiga, and I was just so jealous. I remember going into a friend's house in probably 87, 88, and they just got hold of Style Glider 2. I'm just looking at this, I was just absolutely blown away by just how amazing it looked compared to the N64. And then from a musical perspective, I think there were two tracks which immediately kind of shone way above everything else. It was like, oh my God, that's real music. It was the title sequence, the opening bits of actually, it was a Tim Falling track from a game called LED Storm. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of a nice sort of synthy, washy bit before some guitars and beats came in. I just remember thinking, that just sounds amazing. But the other one as well was Chris Hulsbeck's R-Type.
Oh, yeah.
When I first saw that, I was like, oh, that is just an incredible. Again, real samples from, I mean, most of the samples were the Core Game 1, but very well done. In fact, I believe I nicked the snare drum from R-Type. I've used it on many tracks of my own.
Have you revealed that before?
Well, this is another thing as well. That's also made this more of a challenge, I suppose, is that in my sort of education landscape as well as I am the music landscape. This is about 1989-90. I just finished this musical school. I went to a local sixth form college, did A-levels, and course in music and computers. Getting to meet more people, because obviously at that point, when you get to A-levels, there were more people who were specialised in doing music like you were. Most of them, if they wanted to express themselves musically by writing stuff, the only way you could do that cheaply was using a four-track, which was effectively the old cassette format. Mm-hmm. But rather than just using effectively stereo on one side, stereo on the other time, it used both sides of the tape at the same time to enable you to record four different inputs.
Yeah, I remember those little mixers you could get, the four-track mixers. Yeah.
And I realised that the Amiga, with its four channels of 8-bit samples, was my equivalent. It's exactly the same thing for me. I had four channels which I could do whatever I wanted. I could sample whatever I could get hold of. But again, the limitation I had was no money. Therefore, I didn't have any sound sources. I didn't have any synthesizers. I didn't have any samplers. So I was, first tracks were, just pretty much getting hold of Soundtracker discs, which obviously was a piece of piss. Mm-hmm. I can say piss, can't I? Like a piece of piss to nick the samples and slowly build up your own collection of stuff. And of course, Soundtracker, when it first was shipped, posted to me, it came with this famous ST01, the original Soundtracker sample. No sound sources of my own. I would try and acquire as many sounds as I could from other, basically ripping sounds from other people's modules and using their own stuff. I then went out and managed to find, I bought a master sound sample for £30, which simply had a mini jack. And then I could go and plug in what I wanted. So I could borrow my mate's portable CD player and fire in stuff. And the great thing about it is you start listening to music in a slightly different way. Mm-hmm. You get hold of your pop stuff, you get hold of your albums, and you listen to stuff to see for exposed instruments. I can sit there and go, that's a drum loop. It starts with a drum loop on its own. I'm having that. it's a brilliant bit there. It's just gone down to a bass guitar. It's a nice long bass now. I like that. Thank you very much. And then thinking again, where can we get a hold of some new sounds? Now, I was already becoming quite friendly with a guy I met at a demo scene party who lived in North London. He went by the name of Dark Elf. He had an Amiga 2000 with a hard drive. Those days, that was rocket science, seeing stuff load that quickly. And he and I would spend a couple of weekends together a month playing games and eating Chinese food and watching films in the cinema. And his dad was a... I think it was a sound recorder, sound engineer for, I think it was a CBS or NBC, one of the big news places. And in fact, he went and captured sound for during the Iraq War. But as a result, he had a really good home setup for sound. He had a couple of Nakamichi Dragon tape players, which were $2,000. They had like Dolby S, which I'd never even heard of. Best quality tape players I'd ever seen. He also had a portable, I think it was a portable Sony Walkman, but again, one you could record to. And so that was that was a game changer. He was quite a big lad, so he could hide the machine kind of under his left armpit. However, have a mini jack would come down through his coat, whatever was wearing in his arm, in his sleeve, and then we would go to music trade shows, walk around, put on a suit to look vaguely respectable to try and somehow blag a press pass or some kind of company pass, and then go up and go, wow, there's the new Yamaha keyboard, there's the new Roland keyboard, and this is. Plug in the cable in the back, And then I was sitting there going, right, as a C2, C3, C4. So, and then choose different sounds and go through and do major, minor C, major, minor C, major, minor, different octaves, and try and record as many sounds as we possibly could before getting noticed by the attendant at this, whoever was running the stand.
That's a cheap way of building up an amazing sample library.
Yes. It was a little bit limited because, of course, you never quite have the chord you wanted when you were doing a track. Correct.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the Amiga demo scene and the C64 demo scene, that is where the most creative people who eventually went on to work in the commercial industry, I think, began. Would you agree that that was kind of a hotbed of talent back then?
Of course. At the time I was involved, like anything else, at the time you don't really think about it in that way. You're thinking about it, I just need to get a hold of something here. What's the best way I can do it with limited resources? And obviously, as soon as the internet became predominant, it changed the landscape of everything. Mm-hmm. See, and there were a lot of reasons why, a lot more benefits why there were initially these sort of demo scene meetups were originally called copy parties. Mm-hmm. That's really what they were. You're going to get together a group of demo scene dudes in a school hall in the middle of somewhere on a kind of Saturday during the day, and effectively they'd be all turning up with their stuff and piles of floppy disks. And just effectively copying stuff for people.
X-copy going all day.
Yeah. X-copy all day. You know, yeah, it was poor drives. Didn't know what to hit them. I suppose I didn't really know, but from my perspective, I'm guessing that the reason why the demo scene kind of grew from that, and therefore that's where the meetings became more prevalent in terms of, let's also, while we're copying the games, let's add some other stuff to spice up. Let's see what other demo people have brought along with them. Let's make it into competition. Let's get some artists to come together and bring they've done a great bit of work in Dulux paint. Let's put them over an art competition. Let's go, a load of composers turn up with a copy, with their latest modules, and let's see where a music competition goes. I could see it evolving clearly from there. But initially, I believe that the reason why it all started in the first place is because they were effectively copying stuff.
So you had the group of guys, you had the collection of samples. How did this lead to you getting to do your most famous tune, Swiv?
The initial start, in fact, I've actually just written this. I actually wrote a sort of a tribute yesterday, because rather sadly, I don't know if you're aware, there was a guy called Fergus McGovern, who was the managing director of Probe Software, which was a big games developer back in the 80s and 90s. Rather sadly died all of a sudden on last, I think it was just over a week ago.
Yeah, we covered it in our show last week, actually. Very sad news.
Yeah, it was. And he was based in Croydon. So I will sort of regard this tale because it's sort of vaguely relevant. Croydon, obviously, being where I'm from. Then what happened is that I was beginning to go to these sort of demo scene events, and I started entering music competitions. I think the first one I entered, I came third, and the second two I won. So I was getting noticed by people who were there. And there were a lot of people there a few years older than me who were in the demo scene, but they actually worked in the games industry. And they would quite happily say to me, you know, this I think called Brian those days, this stuff is good enough to go into games. And I was, I'm a 16-year-old kid. You know, I'm not going to be thinking, that's a real person's job. Why am I doing that? But I did sort of go away and think about it. I went, maybe they are. What's the worst that can happen? So, being from Croydon, I looked up and there were two local developers, a company called Grand Slam and Probe Software. I contacted them both, and Probe invited me to their offices. And they offered me, they basically just started listening to some of the music. And Fergus, the guy who ran the company, walked into the meeting and sort of had a little listen to my very basic, simple modules at the time, and liked them. And there on the spot, said, how about, would you like to kind of write music for this game called Supremacy? And I was like, okay, come and write it in our offices. But they wanted an orchestral score. And the truth is, I had no orchestral samples at all. I had no access to anything like that at all. So I really wasn't a cat's in hell chance that I would have a go. And I've never even tried to write an orchestral piece of music, let alone on the Amiga. So, of course, that was never really going to happen. So it ended up being actually written by Jerome Tell, one of the Maniacs of Noise guys, who'd done some brilliant work for them, probably won a few other games, most renowned for their work on Turbo Outrun for Probe. Anyway, so it didn't happen. But what it did do is it did sort of make me think, because I remember being in that rather hot, sweaty office of theirs, and thinking, I like this. This is cool. This is a wicked place to be. So during the summer holidays of that year, 1990, I rang up all the companies which advertised in Zap 64, the rather big magazine at the time. Got the standard fob off for most of them. I literally rang up and said, who does music for your games? So they put me through to another bundle of staff. And they would put the, yes, please, by all means, send in a floppy disk of your work and we'll put you on file and blah, blah, blah. The polite fob off, but with the possible that it might actually go. Got a call from them a month later. Sales cover based in Battersea. And they said that they're finishing off their game they worked on for the last year or two. Where they want to come looking for some title music. Could I come in and play them some stuff? Now, I'm a firm believer that, you know, the timing and everything else is great. Is very, very, very important factor in these things. Mm. And it was. I'd literally contacted them in September. And so clearly I was still in their short-term memory a few weeks later in October. But I remember going in there. I believe it was October the 15th, 1990. And I do remember walking there. And it was quite a big room, probably 10, 15, 20 guys in there. And they had a computer in the corner and a Mega 500 in the corner. And I was so nervous that I literally fired it up and just stared at the screen. I refused to look around. I was just so nervous of what I just came about. So I blinkered myself, stared at the screen, and just basically slowly played played a game, you know, played a track which I'd written for whatever reason, either just for fun or for whatever. And there were kind of a fair few guys laughing and joking and milling around in the background. And I would just sort of play a track. And this one track, which I'd written for a demo which hadn't been released, called Decimation, they all went quiet. Again, refusing to look around and thinking, they hate it, it's awful. The producer tapped on my shoulder and said, we would like to buy this piece of music as the title music for our game. I was like, really? Okay. And I think for me, what made it particularly poignant was the fact that, the high school music, in fact, I think the high school music from Swiv has the snare drum, which I pinched from R-Type. Sorry, Chris. I'm going to fess up to that now.
It got a lot of use, didn't it, that snare drum?
I believe I used the same snare drum sample that he used in R-Type. It was a brilliant snare drum sample.
And it's a really good tune as well. Like, the samples, I love them at the beginning, and then it goes into the 80s vibe. It's like great.
It's very 80s. But again, I was, and the funny thing is, I wrote it originally for, I could even vaguely remember, they showed me, the guy who was writing the demo at the group Ecstasy I was in, he showed me kind of ideas of what he was going to do. So I'd written it to kind of match the three different areas of the demo. Demo actually never got finished, so it was largely pointless. But I'd written the sort of the 80s drum bit for like a kind of more action-y bit, and the opening sort of more ethereal bit, for sort of a spacey type thing he was doing. So yeah, it was a very, for me, I can still listen to it now and thinking I knew what that was supposed to be attached.
Yeah. It's like kind of a dark, gothy 80s or kind of, you know.
Yeah, it totally is. And I forget exactly where I got the samples from, a variety of different places. But yeah, it was one of those strange things. And it was great to sort of suddenly see people lift up and sort of get so. And I got asked, it's funny to say you say that, I still get emails about it now, 25 years later.
Wow.
But anyway, so the next trade show we went to, I think Bobby and I were trying to blag our way in. And this time we had to, rather than just giving our names, we had to give a company name. And so we decided to make up a company name of Dense Design. Dense Design, because his computer name was Dark Elf and my computer name was Nightshade. So DNS, Design, it's alliterate, it's quite nice, so we'll just do that. And I hadn't really thought about trying to get more work and everything else. We were just simply like, just sort of still buzzing from the fact that we'd done Swift. But I remember going up to, I think it was Accolade. They were test drive. Remember the game Test Drive? Brilliant game. They had they were test driving their new version of the game. And I remember going, oh, can we go and have a go at it? Yeah, brilliant. Okay, absolutely. So I was playing this, and this woman just looked at my badge and looked up at me while I was playing. Said, so what can you design for us? And I went, what? What? Sorry, I'm the question. Oh yeah, of course. Oh yeah, Dead Sun. Yeah, we do music for games. Oh great. Got a business card? No. Got a showreel? No. But you know what? If you give me your card, I can send you something. Completely and utterly.
Get you a jiffy bag in the post.
We're absolutely completely ill prepared for this thing. But that's, again, that spark is all it needed. At that point, and suddenly this trade show took a whole new landscape. At that point, then we decided we were going to go around and just chat to all the companies and offer our services. Because literally, we only put it down on the form to blag our way in free for whatever this trade show, computer show was. In order to get in, we hadn't really thought about anything more than that, but put on the spot, of course, that's what we're going to be doing. But I went and see all the companies. In fact, I was offered a job at Probe Software, Fergus McGovern's company. I hadn't written music for the Supremacy back in 1990, and I never thought I'd hear from them again. But in early 1995, I had a phone call from a guy called Tim May, who was a producer there, saying he'd give my name from somewhere. Would I like to come in and work on the music for FIFA 96 on the SNES and the Mega Drive? So I spent, of course, said yes, not having a single clue how to do music on the Mega Drive and the SNES, because the dev kits for those machines were particularly expensive. I wasn't registered. I was never going to be. It was kind of prohibitively expensive for me at the time. But I knew a little bit about them from a technical perspective. So I went in there and worked with their wonderfully talented in-house guy called Andy Brock, who I became good friends with. And we spent a month or so working on that in 1995. And in fact, they offered me a job. But at that point, I had already agreed, been to a trade show and visited a studio in Cambridge, where I live now, a company called Millennium Interactive. I'd known about them for a number of years. I'd never got any work with them because I was working with a guy called Richard Joseph. The reason I chose to go for a job there is because they had built simply the best recording studio I had ever seen a games company build. They spent about third of £1 million, if I'm right.
Wow.
And back from a purely audiophile geek perspective, they had 32 track Pro Tools back in 1995.
Well, obviously, after that, with games, though, I mean, you kind of went from that, you know, the digital kind of, you know, your Pro Tracker stuff, and but then you went to CD audio around that time as well. Did you notice that was a massive change?
Well, that was probably the single biggest change, because you were going from SID chip music, or basically music being generated simply by the sound chip of the device you're working with, to sample being triggered on the Amiga and the SNES, and to a lesser extent the Mega Drive, and then what made digital audio available was basically the advent of CD-ROM. But yeah, again, it all changed. I would say the most popular. Was it the most popular? Probably was the most popular CD-based one. Must have been the PlayStation, which came out in August 24th, 1995. I remember having dinner with a guy called Phil Harrison, because he was my mentor in the games industry's brother-in-law, him telling me that the world is PlayStation. Which is the point, at that point in time, it really was. In the gaming world, Sony had come out of absolutely nowhere in 1995, released the PlayStation, totally wiped the floor with the likes of the Mega Drive and the SNES.
Do you remember the first time you saw it?
Oh, absolutely. I originally saw the original T-Rex demo at one of the trade shows. I think Phil Harrison was actually demonstrating it in 1995 or 1994. But in fact, the day it came out, my boss at the time, Chris Homer, he went into shop and bought one. I think it was £400 or £500, I can't remember. And I think we had, was it Wipeout and Bridge Racer and possibly Tekken or something like that? And installed, yeah, and basically bought it in and plugged it into the studio. And people were coming in and we were playing. I forget if it was Ridge Racer or Wipeout. But I remember obviously being just blown away by the graphics. But from a sound perspective, hearing the real tunes come out of the machine, because I mean, Wipeout had one of the first games to really make use of a licensed track to make it. I mean, Wipeout just was one of those, just like, it's just the epitome of cool. It had the Designers Republic doing the graphic design on it, I think on the game as well as the box, the art and everything else. And it had these tracks from, I think it was Fotech had done a track.
Prodigy on there as well, wasn't there?
Firestarter.
Oh. Yeah, Prodigy. Yeah,
there was. I think there was. There might have been a few Sound of London track on there. But the rest was written by the in-house composer Tim Wright and Mike Clark, who also did a fabulous job.
Yeah, we've just had them on, actually.
Yeah, well, they're lovely chaps, aren't they?
Yeah.
Anyway, so, and I remember hearing this CD quality music, playing Wipeout in this great, nice sound system in the studio. But the thing which really struck me is when you went into a tunnel, everything had reverb. It suddenly sounded like I was in a tunnel. This is the first time I had ever experienced this before. I thought, this is amazing, because the PlayStation had a built-in hardware reverb. So you could sit there and make it sound echo without using any CPU tiles. Oh, this was amazing. And so, yes, and it was great, because obviously then working with Sony behind the company, it was the only platform which we were working on.
Well, Andrew, we've actually come to the end of our show now, because we're only an hour long anyway, but it's... It's been absolutely fascinating reminiscing about the old days. And just quickly, buddy, if people want to catch up with what you're doing these days, where can they find out?
Okay, well, a website. In a nutshell, we are Bob and I, well, Paul Arnold, who we named Bob, we left Sony in 2001 and started our own company called Bob and Barn. And now we seem to do more work on games as well before some film TV. So we have a website, bobandbarn.com, bobandbarn.com, which we very rarely update. We're terrible. We have a Facebook page, same thing, which again, probably update more regularly. And what I'm up to at the moment? Well, this year, we've quite randomly done the music for a TV show which aired on Channel 4 here in the UK called Dispatches. And the big one is we are writing music for a launch title for PlayStation VR, which is coming out, I think, towards the end of the year. It's called Rigs. It's a mech warrior game. We're going to be recording a month or two's time. We're going to be recording an orchestra and a choir and guitars and various instruments for that. But there you go. So,
sounds excellent, Andrew.
Yeah, well, the VR stuff's quite a leap forward from Swiv, isn't it? Yeah.
Just a bit.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much. It's been lovely talking to you.
Thank you very much. See you soon.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.